Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined, as ever, by my dad, John Wyatt. How are you, John?
Hello, yeah. Looking forward to the conversation.
And excitingly today, we've got a third person to join to the discussion. We've got Dr. Sarah Foote. Sarah, we're really delighted to have you joining the podcast. Could you introduce yourself a little bit and explain what you do when you're not recording podcasts?
Hi, Tim and John. Thanks for having me on. So I'm a palliative medicine doctor. So I'm a qualified doctor and I am working in the east of England, training to be a palliative care consultant. So I rotate around different hospitals and hospices, doing palliative care, looking after people as they come towards the end of their life. Currently working in an acute hospital in Essex.
And Sarah, you were telling us just before we came online that you've been absolutely in the midst of caring for patients today. You're actually in the hospital at the moment. What's your day been like so far? What have you been up to?
So we always begin the day with a MDT meeting on a Wednesday where we just update amongst
MDT?
What's that mean?
So
thanks, John. So it's a multidisciplinary team meeting. So for us, that means meetings between nurses and doctors. Often members of the chaplaincy team and the counselling team all come together to discuss the patients that are in the hospital and patients that are in our local hospice, because we're all one big team, even though we're in slightly different geographical locations, just to update each other. So we did that, and then I saw the patients in the ward, and then it's just sorting out jobs for the patients. Things like liaising with oncology teams, so cancer teams, helping get patients get procedures done, get patients home, sorting out changing their medications, that sort of thing.
Could we just take a brief step back? Because I mean, I'd love to dig into a bit more about what your day-to-day job is like, but some people listening might not have never heard the word palliative care. Could you give us a kind of brief elevator pitch about what is palliative care?
Yeah, so palliative care is caring for patients who have a diagnosis which will be the kind of illness that could potentially end their life. So cancer is a really common one, and it was traditionally where lots of palliative care can happen. But actually, we care for any patient who has an illness that may end their life. So patients with lung disease or heart disease, some patients with dementia, anything that you're unwell, and we can come in at any point. I think often people think palliative means hospice, or that means the very end. Actually, we like to do a lot of parallel care, which is where you might have a specialist team looking after you. For example, the cardiologists look after heart disease, but we come in as well to help manage your kind of other needs, things like managing your symptoms or planning for the future.
I think a lot of people imagine that you switch to palliative care once you've abandoned efforts to cure the illness, but that's actually not the case necessarily.
Yeah, definitely not. It's one of the challenges of working in palliative medicine is people think once everyone else has failed, then we go down the palliative route. And that can be our colleagues can sometimes think that. They think that patients should only come to us when they have that when they can't do any more from their end. That's really changing. It's one of the exciting things about palliative medicine is that we do things like joint clinics and early referrals, where once someone's got a certain diagnosis, we start getting involved early. And sometimes early involvement is just saying hello when things aren't, you know, when you don't need us, but at least you said hello, rather than when you do need us, we're a friendly face then, someone you recognise.
So why on earth would you choose to go into this branch of medicine? I mean, when you think of all the other things you could be doing, more positive and more encouraging, people getting better and saving lives, why on earth would you choose to go into a branch of medicine where you know that pretty well everyone's going to die?
Do you know, I think the first time I told my husband who's not a doctor, I want to do palliative medicine, that was exactly what he said, was, why would you do that? And it's a good question. I think people think it's really depressing because ultimately everyone dies. But actually, there's a few things about it I really love. So firstly, I think when you're coming towards the end of your life, you potentially could be quite vulnerable. You've got really hard decisions to make. You're often quite unwell, so making big decisions is actually really difficult. As a patient, for doctors and nurses, things can be quite complicated, and people and like healthcare professionals can feel quite lost. And so, as a palliative care physician, you can really advocate for patients at the end of their life. You can, you know, really stand up for what's important for them, whether it's getting out of hospital or attending an event or sorting out a certain symptom above other things. So I think that's really a really great part of it. And I've already talked about the MDT, or the multidisciplinary team meeting. Some branches of medicine, you only really talk to other doctors most of the time, when we all sort of think the same. And actually, one of the interesting parts of palliative is you get to work with nurses and counsellors, therapists, so like physiotherapists, occupational therapists. You all have to come together and really work together as a team, because it's not just about fixing the one physical, you know, problem this patient has. It's about helping the patient work out what's the most important thing for them, and working out what you can do as a team. And I think that leads on to the real best bit about palliative is I'm not just there to fix your broken leg or cure your infection. So I'm not just like, oh, this patient's got a chest infection, here are the antibiotics. It's, you really get to find out much more about who you're looking after, because it's so crucial. You know, if you're a patient who's got a big family and a big house and lots of support, and you're feeling very happy at home, and actually you want to spend time at home, and that's really important to you, that's something I need to know about. Or I need to know that if the thing that you want more than anything is to see your dog, I need to know about that. Or, you know, if you're trying to sell your business because you've had this diagnosis and that's really weighing you down, because you're stuck in hospital with rubbish internet and no phone signal, you know, these are the things that matter to our patients. And I love that aspect of palliative care. It's much more holistic in that we get to know the whole patient.
Yeah, and what about the spiritual aspects? Because I know that that's also quite a big deal, isn't it, in palliative care? Perhaps surprisingly, you know, people would think that medicine really shouldn't be very interested in spiritual things or in religion. But what's your experience of that?
Yeah, actually, it's one of the other great things as a Christian, that you come to palliative care, and it's one of the areas of medicine where we're really encouraged to talk about it. So the NHS can feel quite secular at times if you're a Christian. We've got to be really careful not to upset patients. You know, we've, in a secular organisation, it's important. Patients are in a really vulnerable position. So if we're talking about faith, it needs to be the right time for the patient and in the right way. And that is the same, that's true in palliative medicine, but actually we're actively encouraged to find those right times and right places, because it's important for patients. If they've got spiritual needs, if they are hoping that their own say pastor can come in or imam, then we need to be helping them sort that out and sorting that. If people have got needs around death, in terms of seeing someone from their religion just before they die, or having someone come just after death, or sorting things out. So for example, in Islam, patients need to be buried quite swiftly. So helping patients get all that planning in place is really important. So actually we're encouraged to be talking to our patients about this so that we know, and we do that in a gentle fashion. Some patients, when you ask them if they have spiritual needs, will just say, well, I'd like a pint of Guinness, does that count? And I'm like, yes, that counts, that's what's important to you. And other people go, oh, I can have someone come and pray with me. And they don't know that we have a hospital chaplaincy team. And that's really easy for us to, you know, refer to the chaplaincy team to come and spend some time with the patient. And chaplaincy love that. That's what they're here for.
And do you not ever feel like, I didn't sign up for this, I was trained in the body, not in the spirit, and I should just pass off all these weird kooky requests to the trained kind of religious professional in the chaplain?
Oh, I don't think I've... it's a good question, because I don't think I've ever thought that. Maybe it's because I'm Christian and I know that, for me personally, my faith will be really important as I come to the end of my life. You know, my father-in-law is a vicar, and I know he's done last communion with family members, and they've really, really valued that. And I know when he goes to visit parishioners, and just having someone pray with you as you come to the end of your life is just so, so valuable. And I'm really happy if a patient is Christian and says they want someone to pray with them. I will often at that point offer up and say, well, actually, I'm Christian. Would you like me to pray with you? And that's particularly if I have a concern about the chaplaincy team getting there in time, or just because I've got a good rapport with patients. Sometimes it's nice, you know, for someone they know rather than for someone random to turn up and pray. I don't think I do see it as kooky or strange. I think it's because all I care about is what's important to the patient. Yeah, I think I'm fairly open-minded. I'm racking my brains. I'm sure I've been asked things that I thought maybe was a bit strange, but if that's what's important to them, that's what's important to them. So it's important to me.
And what's your experience overall? Do you find it, I mean, there must be an aspect of watching people die and being involved, you know, with grieving relatives, and which must be quite stressful and heavy to carry, as well as the good aspects. What do you find the most difficult part of your job?
I think I've been reflecting on this recently, actually, and I think the difficulty actually comes when the planning isn't in place, the relationship's not there, and that happens often in a slightly more acute setting. As well as doing palliative medicine, I do have to still do what we call general internal medicine or acute medicine. And actually, I bring to acute medicine my palliative skills, and almost on any... So as an acute medicine doctor, we see the new patients coming into hospital. They come in, they see A&E, and if you're an adult, you don't need surgery, but you're coming into hospital, you're probably coming in under what we call like acute medicine. And lots of patients, well, on at least every shift I do doing that, there'll be a patient coming in who is very unwell and is likely to die in quite a short time, and trying to build rapport and have difficult conversations, and then do the best thing for the patient in what can be quite constrained circumstances, you know, in an A&E department, on a shift where I know I'm never going to see this patient again, and I'm trying to put plans in place for a night shift. I think those are the ones that stick with me, because it's the confidence of knowing that I've helped the patient as well as I can, or just knowing that things, sometimes life is just really, really hard and awful, and some people have suddenly become ill completely unexpectedly, or sometimes people have been ill and they've known they're ill, but then things take a real sudden turn, and things like when patients can't say goodbye to relatives, and relatives don't get in time, or if they have symptoms as they die, if they're in, you know, if it's all very sudden. I think that's when it's really hard as a doctor.
Mm. And inevitably, you know, in my own clinical experience over the years, you do see some absolutely appalling, terrible things, don't you? And trying to find a way psychologically and spiritually to cope with that? Is it at times difficult? I mean, what's your own experience of when you feel that you're personally taking the toll?
I often you sort of drive home and you think about this. Often it will be more than one patient. You know, you seem to have a run of patients dying, and it just seems so overwhelming. How overwhelmingly difficult life can be. And you know, you'll meet perhaps people who are young, or people who've had other things go wrong, or people who've had multiple bereavements, and a real sense of crying out to God. You know, just. It's okay to just be like, why is this? Mm. And, you know, I know we live in a fallen world, but sometimes you can't see any, you know, there's no obvious good in a situation. And also being thankful to God, I find really helpful, actually, to thank God for just his generous grace and goodness, and trusting and having a real trust in God's judgment, in God's love for us all. Sometimes I wonder how my colleagues who don't have a faith manage the burden of seeing illness and death, and not having a sense that there is a God in control of it all, and a God that who really loves us. I mean, people do, you know, we have coping in terms of counselling sessions, in terms of, you know, people do things like mindfulness, making sure that you're making time for yourself. But that overwhelming sense of just knowing that God has got this is a real comfort.
Is there a kind of Christian ethos that lies behind some of the philosophy of palliative care? Because it seems slightly distinct from perhaps, as you say, the more secular kind of humanistic, materialistic ethos that runs through kind of general medicine.
Yeah, so palliative is quite a new specialty in the world of medicine. New is about 60 years old, but we're still quite a new specialty. And actually, it was founded by a Christian lady, Cicely Saunders, and she sort of came up with the idea of having a hospice somewhere where we would care for people. And she's got a great quote, which I'll say now, which I think really sums it up. So this quote is, "You matter because you are you, and you matter to the end of your life. We will do all we can not only to help you die peacefully, but also to live until you die." And I think it really sums up palliative, where it's all about loving the patient and loving them for just existing, for just being a person. And that's quite distinct from, I mean, you know, medicine is all about caring for people, and it's generally about fixing things, though. And we can't fix dying, but we can come alongside you. And again, I think that's a really a Christian view, is where we, you know, we're traveling this journey together, and we aren't in control of it. And I think our current society, control is a really important thing for people. It's something people really value, and we can't control everything. As a doctor, I want to control it. I'm always disappointed if I can't fix symptoms, but what I can do is travel the journey with you.
And I think one of Cicely Saunders' great conviction was that those last few hours, days, weeks of someone's life could actually be profoundly significant and rich and important. It wasn't all just doom and gloom. I mean, that's really, isn't it? That's why this quote, "to live until you die." I mean, how have you seen that personally in your own experience?
I mean, away from my professional time, when my husband's granddad was dying, my husband and I went to visit him, what turned out to be in the last sort of 12 hours of his life, and we went to visit him in hospital, and he was a Christian with faith, and I asked him if he wanted us to pray together, and he could just about say yes. And it was something, like, my husband is Christian as well, and I think it's just something I needed to initiate because it was something I was more used to. I was more used to being in a room with someone who was so unwell. And we prayed together. And I remember the door opening and not really paying much attention. But actually, it was another member of the family coming in who then prayed with us. And I didn't really think much of it. But actually, that was a member of family who has potentially moved a little bit away from God in their relationship. But there was something about that moment, that precious moment where we all prayed together. And that was a really important thing for the family to know that actually my husband's granddad did get a chance to pray with one of his sons, you know, right coming towards the end of his life. And then again, in our family, elderly relatives with dementia, dementia is a hard diagnosis. You lose control of who you are. It's scary for the patient, it's scary for relatives. But again, we've had really profound changes in relationships where relationships have been formed and nurtured and reborn during that time. And certainly for me, coming into my husband's family, when we got married, his grandmother couldn't attend our wedding because she was too unwell. And we did, she was in a nursing home with a little area where we could kind of do a ceremony. And we went and did that the week after we got married. And it was really, really special. And she was absolutely delighted. And we've got a wonderful photo of her from that day. And it's just a really precious memory that we have that we wouldn't have had otherwise. It's not always like that, but there is still really good quality time. And actually, patients often say that to me. It's one of my, I really want, when I'm advocating for patients, one of the things I want to do is be honest with them that I think time could be short, that they are dying. Because as doctors, doctors often don't want to tell patients that. No one wants to tell someone they're dying. But if we withhold that information, if we don't own it and say, actually, we do think this patient's going to die, even though we're telling them we're trying to cure something, for example, we take away their opportunity to have that time with their family. And I've had patients say, or relatives say to me, thank you so much, because we had a week together. You thought he was going to die within a week or two, and he did. And we had a precious week of just wonderful time together. And
I think that it certainly is my experience too, that, you know, the quality and the richness of time is nothing to do with the duration, with how many days, weeks, months. It's, you know, that just some short period, minutes, hours, days, can be so significant. And particularly, you know, for those who remain, I think that my experience often isn't that it's the relatives, you know, because we have to live, we've watched this person, this loved one die, but now we have to live with what happened over those last few hours and days. And to be able to live with memories that, yes, wasn't that an amazing time we had together, is really significant.
Yeah, it's something that I see as part of our holistic care, is you as the patient are going to care about how your family are. And so I need to care about how your family are. Obviously, my patient's most important, but it really matters to me that we, particularly in these COVID times, visiting is often very restricted. And recognising that someone is dying is really important to allow more visitors to be able to come in. And it's certainly one of the things that really troubles me is if we miss that, if we don't get, and we get it wrong, because death is really unpredictable. And sometimes we don't do that. And I'm really broken for the relatives who I know haven't had a chance to say goodbye.
And that was obviously something that was particularly painful for people during the worst of the COVID pandemic we've been gone through here, is that, well, at least certainly in the UK, most hospitals kind of barred all visiting. And so there were lots and lots of people who sadly did die without any family members able to let alone a chaplain or someone able to come in and be by their bedside.
I think there will be a real epidemic of bereavement within our country and around the world because of the huge numbers, but also because of that, because people weren't there, they couldn't see how their relative was, and they couldn't be with them, and they couldn't, just being with them is so important. It's absolutely heartbreaking, and something I hope we can perhaps prepare better for in future, because we obviously have to keep people safe and social distancing is really important. And I don't envy policymakers who made these decisions, but also I saw so many people who didn't get to say goodbye, and it's just heartbreaking. And not even just goodbye, but just that good time together, those last laughs, those last memories, and knowing that people want to be able to care. They want to be able to be by the bedside and make sure that their relative is, you know, well hydrated, that their lips are not dry, that they're not in pain, and they all miss that. And it's heartbreaking, and I don't know how that's going to pan out.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I suspect that is going to be one of the long-lasting effects of the pandemic, not the physical effects of long COVID and all that, but actually those psychological scars and what psychologists call a complicated grief. You know, there's the grief of losing a loved one, but then there's all this complication of the fact that I couldn't be there and I missed out, you know, and I feel a failure and she died alone and all those kind of feelings to be worked through.
Yeah, and then often relatives will blame themselves, not rightly, did they catch COVID because I was getting the food shopping and bringing it to them, you know, because often people would have COVID, you know, multiple members of family at the same time, and it's all just, as you say, complex, and we will see the effects of that for years to come.
One of the things that really fascinates me, to slightly move the conversation on, is you mentioned that palliative care is quite a modern phenomenon, at least in the terms of the history of medicine. How kind of widespread or well integrated is it into the rest of the NHS, at least the healthcare system we have here in the UK? Is it does every patient who wants it, do they have access to it, or is it more patchy?
No, I think it's fair to say it's more patchy. So I think because we traditionally have been quite cancer focused, we still see predominantly cancer patients, so we often have very good links with cancer services. We are increasing links with services where it's, you know, like kidney doctors or renal services or cardiologists, lung doctors, but also we struggle to get to groups of patients that are harder to reach. So patients that perhaps have substance misuse or substance addiction, or who might not have a permanent home, or patients that anyone who's dying in a kind of non-standard way, we are not getting to them well enough yet, and it's definitely changing and it's definitely improving. There's some really exciting projects reaching out to patients in homeless shelters. There's lots of clinics, like I said, clinics being set up with patients who are have, say, lung disease or kidney problems. And it's certainly within the hospital setting. It's still, we need more of us. There's not enough doctors and nurses within the hospital, so our colleagues don't fully understand what we can do, so don't always refer at the right time. We're quite a small specialty, so for example, in my current hospital, there is only one consultant and me as the registrar, so that's it. There's only two doctors doing my specialty here in this hospital, so we don't see enough of our colleagues to help them understand when they should be referring. And then hospices are generally in the charitable sector. So it's quite a bizarre system. If you thought about, say, giving birth in this country, you'd never dream you needed to go to a charity like run organisation to give birth. You just go to hospital. But for good reasons, traditionally, the charity sector has picked up as the hospices. But that means it's quite patchy, because it is, you know, where someone has thought to build a hospice and then there's a charity to help run it. And that means that it's not being kind of commissioned and fairly laid out.
Yeah, I think it's really one of the bizarre things about the UK system is that palliative medicine and palliative care is in this rather Cinderella type subject. And actually there's a kind of tragic comic aspect to all this, and that is that the NHS allocates funding in a very sort of rigorous utilitarian way, which is based on something called QALYs, which stand for quality adjusted life years. So what you do is you calculate how many life years your treatment is going to buy. And then the more life years your treatment buys, the more money will go into that area of care. And of course, the thing about palliative care is that it's very expensive, and yet people only live for days or weeks or months. So in other words, it doesn't buy any life years at all. So the whole basis on which funding within the NHS is directed just doesn't work for palliative care. It has to be commissioned in a completely different way, and I think that is part of the reason why it is massively underfunded.
Yeah, we're just not financially, it doesn't make any sense. It is all about what is actually important to people, and it is important to care for you whilst you're still alive. We need to care for you, and we have to advocate for that.
Do you think there's positives in having charities? I imagine many of them still quite Christian in origin, at least. You know, it feels like most hospices are called Saint something or other, kind of betraying their Christian origins. Do you think that's really a good thing to have, to kind of undergird the Christian origins of palliative care?
Yeah, I think it's probably positives and negatives. It's just as with primary schools, people often associate Christian care with being a good thing, that they know someone is just going to care for them because that's what they do because they're Christian. I think actually the reality is whilst lots of hospices were originally Christian in foundation, people of all faiths and none work in them now. And again, they will always have access to chaplaincy support, but they, you know, if you don't have a faith, you're still very welcome. And actually that can be something that can put people off. So I've worked in an area before I went into palliative medicine, but I worked in general medicine in an area where it was quite a small Christian population, and the hospice was a Saint something, and that used to really put off our patients. Some of our patients were just really put off by it. And trying to explain that barrier, to explain it is a name. Yes, traditionally the hospice was run by nuns, but actually now you don't need to have any faith. It's not going to be pushed on you. We are just there to care for you. Can be really, really challenging, particularly actually, again, as a specialty. You know, you can be sort of a white doctor in the middle of an area where you don't look like any of the patients, and trying to speak the same language. And I don't just mean kind of language, but just being, you know, being able to explain things and them trust you can be a real challenge. So I love it. I love that Christians went, you know, we need to sort this out, end-of-life care. We need to set something up. I also want all my patients to have access to end-of-life care, and I'm always really sad if people don't trust the sort of name hospice.
I suppose in trust in your profession, if your specialism is vital in any kind of medicine, but even more so for palliative care, you really need to have that vulnerable, open, honest, trusting relationship between physician and patient.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
Listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
You'll be obviously even more aware than I am, but here in the UK there was a renewed push to try and introduce a form of assisted dying just last year, last autumn, in Parliament. There was a bill was introduced to the House of Lords. John, you did some kind of work around this. Do you want to briefly explain what that bill proposed and what kind of response it found?
Sure. So it's just by way of background. Here in the UK at the moment, it's completely illegal for a doctor or anyone else to deliberately, intentionally kill someone or hasten their death. So although it's entirely legal and appropriate to stop treatment, life-sustaining treatment, if everyone agrees that that's the right thing to do, the current law draws a very clear line between that and intentional killing using lethal poisons. And what is being proposed is that the law should be changed here in the UK, as in it indeed has in many countries across the world, to allow doctors to prescribe lethal medications for patients who meet particular criteria. They have to be competent, in other words, legally aware of their decisions. They have to be give a voluntary and free desire to kill themselves, to feel their lives is not worth living. And they have, in the UK law, proposed that they had to have a terminal illness with less than 6 months to live. And so there was debate as to whether to legalise what was called assisted dying, doctors giving lethal poisons to terminally ill patients. And I was involved, along with a number of other people, in trying to oppose this legislation, and we listened to what was a very high quality debate which went on in the House of Lords over the space of an entire day. I think there were over 100 contributors, some arguing passionately for changing the law, some arguing passionately against. But what I found very striking and also rather disturbing was the number of, to be honest, rather elderly peers who recounted stories of their friends or relatives or people close to them who died, who clearly had an appalling death. Sometimes they describe people screaming out in agony. They said they pleaded with the doctors or the nurses to do something, and the professional said, no, we're not allowed, we can't give any more drugs. And there were these repeated stories gave the impression that palliative medicine, as it exists today, is pretty powerless when it comes to controlling people's pain and symptoms at the end of life. And I just wonder whether you got that impression, Sarah, and how you responded to that.
Yeah, it's really, really hard because you hear these stories of people dying in pain and miserable, and it's heartbreaking. And whatever side of the debate you're on, that's the sort of first response. And I don't doubt they're happening. And I think where we've had the health and social care bill more recently, actually recognising that, as I said last week, that palliative care isn't currently accessible to everyone, that should be one of our first focuses, is making sure people do have access to palliative care, because things like pain is actually not one of the more difficult things that we manage. Not everyone dies in pain, and it's certainly also, I think, something to remember is we have these awful stories, and it is heartbreaking, but it's also not common. It's not the reality. I see lots of patients die, and lots of patients die really quite comfortably, and that's because they've had access to the right palliative care. They've been supported in their physical pain relief, but they've also been supported in their emotional and psychological well-being, supported with spiritual care, and that's something that is very achievable. And I guess there will always be some exceptions, but actually caring for someone in a loving fashion, with all the medicines, all the things that we have now in the modern day, we can help people to die comfortably and die well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the impressions I have is that the general lay understanding about people suffering at the end of life is that the principal reason why people suffer at the end of life is because of physical pain. It's because of overwhelming agony created by the disease, by cancer or whatever it is. And I think what is understood by people, and certainly matches my own experience, is that actually that physical pain, by and large, is relatively easy to control with modern methods, modern drugs, modern techniques of controlling pain. What is much more common but also much more difficult is these other types of pain, psychological pain, relational pain, whether a really broken, damaged relationships, and also spiritual or existential pain, people feeling a sense of guilt or a sense of the meaninglessness of life. And it's often these kind of issues which are the real source of suffering as people come to the end of their lives. Does that fit with your experience, Sarah?
Yeah, I think there's often a lot of fear around pain and symptoms, and I think that's because as a society we don't see people die. You know, we've really medicalized it. It happens in hospitals, it happens away from homes, and so people don't get to see a normal death. I've had relatives pull the emergency buzzer when someone's taking their last breath because they've just not seen it before and they're not confident with what's going on. And then actually the real difficulties or the harder things to manage are people who've got broken relationships and don't know how to, aren't going to be able to have another conversation with someone because they can't manage it. Or people who are really scared of losing control or being dependent. That's something that's quite common. As you say, people who angry, understandably so. You know, why is it me? Why am I the one that's dying? You know, I've done everything right. Is it because I smoked, or is it? And you know, people will question things that have absolutely nothing. You know, I say smoking as an example, but actually, I had a patient die recently, and they thought it's because they'd smoked. And I was like, it's not related. It really isn't. I mean, smoking's not good for you, but in that case, it wasn't related, and that's harder, and that's where time with people, being able to listen. I often think of palliative medicine, our kind of super skill is just being able to listen to people, and them being able to share their troubles can be really helpful.
One of the things the people who advocate for changing the law often say is that there is a huge untapped demand from the public for this, and there are various surveys that suggest that when you phrase the question in a certain way, you know, upwards of 80% of people agree that there should be the option for doctors to prescribe kind of life-ending drugs in all various things. In your experience, is it common for patients who are dying to kind of request that kind of currently illegal intervention from you as their physician?
No, it's not common at all, and I don't think. So first of all, I think I think if you word the question to people who haven't considered the issues and say, well, if someone else is in pain, would you want them to have the option of ending their life? You think, well, yeah, you know, why would I want someone to experience pain when we could stop it? And if you haven't considered the issues, I think that it's an understandable response. The reality is actually there's two things. Sometimes patients will say to me they just want their life to be over. Sometimes they say it and hope that in some way I can assist their death. And often that is said by people who might be at the very end anyway. They kind of sort of say they've had enough of life. And actually we find they die quite a short time later. And I think there's a sort of, our people often talk about battling cancer and trying to, you know, make the most of everything. And sometimes you do just get very tired of it all as you come to the end. And actually, as long as those patients are comfortable and loved and reassured that we're not extending their life, that we're not now doing anything that's going to prolong anything, that can bring a real comfort, and to know that they won't be alone. Also, patients can say it when they're in pain. You know, if you can think about a time when you've been in absolute agony, the things you'd have said to make it stop. And if you've got something that you're dying of anyway, you know, you'd want it to stop. Patients have sometimes come into hospital like that. And actually, with good pain relief or good symptom management, I have seen that turn around. I've seen patients cry and beg me to end their life. And actually, one guy particularly I remember was just miserable, and within 2 or 3 days was crying with relief that he was going home to spend time with his wife, because we'd managed his symptoms and actually they were quite straightforward and he got to go home and have good time with her. So I think that's one aspect of it in terms of the people that ask. But then you have all the other people who don't ask, who do just want every minute they're alive to live as well as they can do, and are actually really scared that we're going to make assumptions about their life, that as doctors we've quite written them off. One of my patients, every time I frown in her presence, she thinks I'm writing her off, and I'm like, no, I'm just thinking of how we're going to sort out this problem. I'm not writing you off, because once people have got the label of a palliative diagnosis, they worry that we're going to give up on them, and reassuring them that actually no, this is only where my job begins is really important. And then we meet the patients who, or families where, as doctors, we have to discuss what are called do not attempt resuscitation, so DNAR discussions. And that's something we do separate from palliative care. That is a discussion we do when we are concerned that if a patient's heart were to stop, we wouldn't try to get it started again, because we don't think it will be successful and it will cause them harm and it won't give them a dignified death. I say this because as doctors we are really bad at having these conversations. We can often think we've done a really good job, but actually patients come out of these conversations terrified that we're not going to look after them properly, we're not going to care for them. And that's DNAR, which we're quite familiar with, but that can really break down the doctor-patient relationship. And I worry that with assisted dying, a big concern is it will really break down the trust with patients and doctors, because patients won't know whether we're actually pursuing assisted dying or whether that's what we think is best, because why on earth would you live with, you know, their symptoms or their life? And it will undermine that trust they have in us.
Yeah, it's certainly one of my great concerns as well, because as you say, to be able to, you know, when you're so desperately vulnerable and you feel out of control, you desperately want to be able to trust this professional and believe that they are genuinely acting in your best interests. And the worry that actually they have a vested interest, you know, that they've just come from another patient where they actually helped them die, and that might change the way that they treat you, I think is very strong. And I'm very proud of the fact that we can say, you know, the medical profession is the one profession which is totally dedicated to protecting and preserving life. And you should be able to feel totally confident when you're in the care of a medical professional that they're not going to try and get rid of you, not going to try and end your life prematurely.
I was going to say, there's been quite a lot of debate within the medical profession, certainly here in the UK, about what doctors' kind of stance should be on these attempts to introduce assisted dying. And as far as I understand it, the British Medical Association, which is the kind of professional body for doctors, changed its stance. In your experience, do palliative care doctors kind of tend either direction, pro or anti?
They can be pro or anti, but the overwhelming majority are anti-assisted dying. And I think that's really important. If you look at the British Medical Association survey, obviously the kind of headline is that they went neutral. Actually, if you drill down into that, you see that a lot of the specialties, so the types of doctor that are pro-assisted dying, are not those that are looking after those at the end of their life. It's doctors that aren't very patient-facing anymore, so tend to work more in labs or in radiology departments, some types of surgeon. And then also groups of doctors, so medical students, for example, who, you know, we go back to when we began this session talking about how in an ideal world you sort of think, oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Assisted dying, that helps the people who need it. You don't have to have it. I think it's really interesting that those are the groups that seem to be quite supportive. But actually, palliative medicine doctors, GPs, geriatricians, so those caring for elderly patients, cancer doctors, they were all much more against it. And I think that's because we can see that there's a better way, that actually there are some very vocal people in the news who really want it. But actually we know that if we get a chance to see people, if we get a chance to have these conversations, that there's so many things that we can manage and people just don't know what we can do. And also we've got just this huge cohort of vulnerable people who won't know whether we're supposed to be we're doing assisted dying. And also we'll have the patients who are coerced into it. And it might be that they are doing it because they think it's the right thing. I get patients almost on a daily basis who say to me, oh, you shouldn't be wasting your time with me. And I'm slightly confused by that because my job title is palliative care. That is, I haven't got any other patients to say. I haven't got any that aren't dying. Patients still have this real sense of, you know, the NHS is in need, that they've got, you know, there must be much more urgent operations to do, or patients that you can fix and get out of there, beds that can be freed up, don't waste our time. And that's really, really sad to think that people might think that's the right thing to do is to end their life. People don't know what financial support there is, so they don't know what care support they're entitled to, so they worry that as they come to the end of their life, they might have to pay for everything, or they can't pay for it, so they're just going to be home alone. And then they sometimes think it's the best thing for their family, because they don't want their family to be burdened by caring for them. And that's really difficult to tease out as a doctor, to really get to know patients and their families well enough to be completely confident that actually if a patient's saying they want to end their life, it's not because they're trying to do the right thing. And actually the right thing is to, you know, let themselves be cared for. And we see that a lot.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting. You know, there's very strong evidence of this in places such as the state of Oregon in the USA, where a form of assisted suicide is allowed, is that surveys show consistently that one of the main reasons that why people give for going for the assisted suicide is fear of being a burden to others. So there is a lot of evidence that if once this is legalized, many people will feel driven by a sense of being a burden to their loved ones and their relatives, or even to the NHS, to feel that the decent and the honourable thing to do is to kill myself.
And I worry that with patients who seemingly have awful, you know, patients that say are bed bound or have symptoms that we just perceive as doctors or as nurses and doctors that are just unbearable, we will feel the need to offer it. We need to make sure patients know that it's there. But the reality is patients actually move around medical teams quite a lot in hospital. They see lots of different people. So I worry they will get asked repeatedly. And they will hear of other people in the same situation who will end their life and might feel that we sort of think, well, why have they not ended theirs? You know, I'd have done it in their position. And because I think we see that at the beginning of life with some of the laws we have, where we can really impress upon, you know, how we feel, we think we would feel in a situation, and can't believe that someone would react differently. And I worry that will really change the dynamic between patients and staff.
Yeah, Tim, you did some research, didn't you, in Canada, which legalised a form of medical killing, or medical aid in dying, they call it there. And what was your experience there? Because you did some investigative journalism there, didn't you?
It's a little generous. I did some research, shall we say. And if you're interested in this topic, there is actually a whole podcast of Matters of Life and Death from October last year, which I'd recommend you go back and listen to, which talks about the experience in Canada. But yeah, that they legalized what they call medical assistance in dying, or MAID, back in 2016, I think it was, so about 5-6 years ago. And at the time, the issue of palliative care was raised, and it was kind of confidently assured that no, these two systems could run in parallel, and there'd be no reason why palliative care couldn't continue to be invested in, as well as having a kind of euthanasia regime running in alongside it. And then what has happened is what most of the critics, or indeed many in the palliative care sector, warned, which is that inevitably, in a state-funded system, as you said, Sarah, you know, people will get repeatedly asked, and as that becomes more and more one of the kind of menu of options, it's going to increase in prevalence. And so they've seen the numbers kind of steadily rise of people who have opted for MAID year on year, and indeed there is, you know, limited number of dollars in the system, and giving someone a lethal injection is significantly cheaper than providing lengthy complex hospice care over many months. And so even though no one intends to kind of think of it in financial terms, when you have a cash-strapped system much akin to the NHS, the experience there is that many of the provinces who administer healthcare in Canada have found more of their resources going towards MAID because it's cleaner, simpler, efficient, quick. And that means that there are plenty of people out there who would love to have high quality kind of remedial hospice care at home or in an institution, but they don't. And so their options are kind of suffer in substandard care without specialists like yourself and high quality pain control, or take the kind of quick way out, which is a choice that no patient should really be given.
Your description of it, Tim, is just so sickening. Like, queen, click, quick, efficient. Like, it's so sad, isn't it? To think of resources being taken away from palliative care, not being able to care for people as we would want at the end of life, and not valuing people for who they are. It just, listening to you describe it, makes me really sad.
I think one of the things I found really interesting but also troubling was that the idea that actually palliative care and euthanasia could coexist on the same ward. I mean, basically, you could choose. You know, you're dying, you've got a terminal illness. Well, you know, if you want palliative care, you know, and you want to carry on being careful, well, we can provide that. But if you decide your life is not worth living, well, we can end your life as well. So why couldn't euthanasia and palliative care coexist in the same ward?
I think it goes back to that sense of safety, and we talked about the relationship and the trust that you really need to have when you are totally vulnerable, and the idea that you would be providing both in one ward just seems ridiculous. The idea that, you know, one patient we're trying to help you live as long as possible, and the other patient we're ending your life, because it's you know, the value judgment on that we're just like, yeah, that's fine, it is, you've got pain and it's not worth trying to beat that. I think it will just undermine trust and confidence and take away time and energy. I think if doctors are making those decisions, they will rightly and expectedly have to have, I'm sure, second opinions. There'll be lots of paperwork, lots of checkboxes, I'm sure. And that will, I think, of how the reality of a ward is run. You know, we do the ward round with a consultant. There are jobs to be done for each patient. And I can imagine the assisted dying, it's like, well, there's a big legal requirement over this, so we must make sure this is all ticked off, rather than that softer thing where it's just sit with the patient who's also unwell but not going through assisted dying, or maybe spend a bit of time when their relative comes talking through what's going on. That could be diverted as emotional, physical time, resources all go to assisted dying.
Sure. No, I can see that. Let me put you on the spot, Sarah, because, you know, I've retired from clinical practice. You're still at the early stages of your career. It seems, humanly speaking, it's quite likely that within the foreseeable future, some form of assisted suicide euthanasia is going to become legalised in the UK. And I wonder how you think you and others might react to that. Do you think it will be possible to create euthanasia-free zones within the NHS? What are your own thoughts on that possibility?
Yeah, I think we really need to fight for it to be kept, well, for it not to happen, but if it does happen, for it to be kept out of the, I think, out of the healthcare system. I think patients need to be coming to see their doctor, and they know their doctor is not doing assisted dying. I think it's, as you know, they need to know that they are in a safe place, and that they can express disappointment and frustration with life, and the next sentence isn't going to be, oh, would you like to die by suicide? I would love to see that actually having places where assisted dying isn't allowed would be really promoted and celebrated, that, you know, we have places as Cicely Saunders originally set up, you know, hospices, where we go, we don't do that here. That's not what we believe in. We believe in you, and we believe in supporting you. I fear that to prevent there being a postcode lottery, and to be, in quotes, fair to everyone, that actually hospices would be required to do it. And I can't see how that would work. And I certainly can't see how lots of people, lots of palliative doctors would work in that system. I certainly don't know how I would.
I mean, one of the things it reinforces to me is the really important provision of conscience protection for doctors, nurses and other health professionals, that they are protected by law from being forced to participate, to recommend, to advise patients about killing, assisted dying, and so on. And again, that didn't see, although in theory that conscience protection is there in Canada, Tim, I think your experience was it wasn't necessarily that always that strong.
Yes, I was going to say, unfortunately, the kind of portents from Canada, which, you know, obviously is a different country and a different culture, but I think there's a very similar kind of medical ethos and spirit in its healthcare system. It is the case that the law is passed, you cannot be compelled to actually do the lethal injection yourself, but it's really patchy. So I spoke to Canadian doctors, Christians, who in certain provinces, they were basically in conflict with their kind of provincial health board, which said you don't have to physically do it, but you do have to refer patients when asked, and you have to basically be a cog in the machine pushing them towards assisted suicide. And there were doctors who said, oh, that still contravenes my conscience. You know, I will say this is an option, but I'm not going to refer you. You'll have to go to another doctor who does that. I make it clear from the outset that I don't do MAID. And they've been told that's not an option. That's not permissible. That's, if you work in the state-funded provincial healthcare system, you have to take part, which is, I think, really, really concerning if you were a doctor. The other thing I wanted to say, what you said, Sarah, about the palliative, how it would work with the hospice system is, again, it's very similar, because the Canadian Society of Palliative Care Physicians came out very strongly against MAID when it was first legalised. And said it was kind of antithetical to the whole ethos of hospice care to kill patients. But in just a very short space of time, only about 5 or 6 years, that's, you can see in the statistics, that's great, bad, gradually been worn down. So at the beginning, almost all deaths, nobody died from MAID in hospices. They were either on hospital wards or at home. But over time, more and more patients got aware that they could ask for this, and there was a kind of strong activist pro-euthanasia movement which was attacking doctors and institutions that refused them. That it's kind of been worn down, and the last stats I saw, which are only from 2019, so only 4 years after the law came in, 21% now. So that's more than one in five of all deaths from euthanasia were taking place in hospices. So I agree with you that it's vital that we do keep the system separate. But I have to say the evidence from other countries is concerning whether that's going to be possible if it is legalised in the UK.
I'm really glad we got to talk today about, we've been able to talk about palliative care and assisted dying. I am a really strong advocate that we need to be focusing on making sure that palliative care is available to all, good palliative care is available to all. And that says a lot more about us as a society if we are passionate about supporting people, loving people, and helping people have a good death, than going for, as Tim decided, the efficient, clean, quick option of saying, oh, we can't help, we'll just go down the assisted suicide route. Thank you so much for having me today.
Thanks, Sarah. It's been absolutely brilliant to have your insight and your reflections from the ward itself on matters of life and death today. We're really grateful for you taking the time. And thanks to everyone else for listening. I hope you enjoyed this pair of podcasts on palliative care with Sarah. As I mentioned, there's a podcast that me and John did about 6 months ago, which was discussing in more detail some of the research I did into Canada and also the proposed bill here in the UK on assisted dying. So you can look back in the feed and find that. There's also some material on John's website. That's johnwyatt.com. If you just pop in assisted dying, you'll be able to find that. And I recommend to take a look. As ever, if you'd like to get in touch with us, we're always interested to hear from listeners. You can drop us an email at molad at premier.org.uk. But otherwise, we'll see you next week. Thanks very much for listening.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.